KALW.
In dance, there's a special kind of elitism. It's in fine art, it's in everything. It's white supremacy, it's fat phobia.
Today, we meet a four-person multimedia band that's doing dance differently.
And I make a lot of creative decisions based off of trying to undo that.
The band Plié and their genre of gutter pop. Then a San Francisco exhibit celebrates six decades of Filipino artists, culture, and history.
It was inspiring because I was like, these Filipino cartoonists were doing stuff in this industry. I feel like I could do something in this industry.
And we honor a San Francisco icon.
If you'd told me 10 years ago that I would own a nightclub, I thought I would have said you were crazy.
Remembering Heklina. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. The band Plié is a four-person multimedia gutter pop band based in San Francisco.
I was changing shape to fit the box. I was changing.
Gutter pop is a genre name they coined themselves. They say it's part pop music, part contemporary ballet, and part so much more. And since the onset of the pandemic, they've released their debut album, Everybody, and they're currently working with Women's Audio Mission to release a second one titled Wealth and Hellness. Reporter Paul C. Kelly Campos brings us their story.
Should we spell plié the way we do on stage? Would that be cute? We're plié, spelled P-L-E-E-A. Why?
Calling all humans, calling all humans, calling.
I'm Castle. I am the fluttering fairy. I sing and I write the lyrics in plié, and I dance a lot on stage and in life. It's pop music in that it's vocals forward. You know, there's a focus on what's being said in the lyrics, but it's so much stuff that it just comes together. It's like a complex color, kind of like something you would see in the gutter. Settled on the band name Plié because ballet is my original, like, performance art form. I've been doing it since I was three, and it's what introduced me to Huli because I was in a dance program for contemporary ballet.
My name's Huli. I am primarily the drummer for Plié, for at least our live performances, but I guess you could say I'm the producer of Plié. I make the backing tracks to support us while we perform live on stage. We met in college back in the late aughts. And I was a music major. Tassel was a dance major. The dancers have senior pieces, and Tassel needed some music for it and effectively commissioned me to write the music that supported their senior piece. And then that turned into three or four more ballets after graduation that I did the music for. Castle wanted to get into the music business rather than the dance business, and we thought it'd be wise to form a group together because we worked so well.
I realized that I wanted to use my voice. I stopped feeling like ballet was a healthy environment for me because of lots of layered reasons, and I wanted to continue to perform. So it felt like being in a band and writing lyrics, and I'd always written poetry, so it just kind of made sense. In dance, there's a special kind of elitism. There's, you know, it's in fine art, it's in everything. It's white supremacy, it's fat phobia, it's cis heteronormativity. It's like just prevalent in these like elitist cultures, and I've spent a lot of time in it. And I make a lot of creative decisions based off of trying to undo that and present the beauty and the fun of dancing and music and performance and art in an accessible way, in a welcoming way that is also like real.
I asked Castle what color they thought they would want like the audience to think that they were, you know, in or like seeing on stage. And Castle answered me honestly and said red. And I was like, okay, I'm gonna go for red. And it worked, dude. Like, it was, I didn't think I could accomplish red, and I accomplished red. A good idea of what I mean by hearing the color red would be Consequence off our first album. It has the kind of anger and grit that you would expect from the color red.
It's pretty cool to watch like ideas come from any of the three of us and kind of have to kind of meet the reality of the other two people in like a really interesting way. I'm Pete and I play bass guitar in Plié. I saw Plié before I was in the band and had met them both after the show, and I think just was like, that was sick. You know, followed them and stayed close with what they were up to. But I ran into Castle and their wife, Hannah, at Simple Pleasures Cafe in my neighborhood. And I think we made plans to work on an artist zine for Plié. And I was like, well, I could also like play bass in your band, who knows? And they were like, bet. Like, yes, we can try that out. But here we are, you know, a year and a half later.
It's been a dream since then, so yeah.
But not before then. It was a nightmare without Pete, and then it turned into a dream.
Yes. No low end.
I have a bunch of poems, you know, Pete has a bunch of bass lines, Huli has a bunch of synth sounds and drum parts, like just packed away that we think of in our own time.
It all sort of merges and becomes this like fourth entity that none of the three of us really wrote alone.
Like different tectonic plates, like something new comes out of it.
On our first album, we have this song called Crave. It was just this sort of riff that I had that had never found a home. Chas and I started working on it.
Crave is about wanting to live a better life and dealing with like the good craving of I'm craving a fuller experience than what I've been in, but also kind of my experience with addiction and like compulsive behavior. So I just wanted it to be manic. I write in my journal like every day, and I wrote our mission statement in my journal today to kind of remind me of it. It is resist the call to conform, choose consciousness over convenience, and live loudly with compassion. Has kind of allowed me personally to feel like I am being seen and heard and kind of accepted in this like hyper authentic kind of way.
I am finally in a band that I'm making a significant contribution to in terms of songwriting and arrangement and composition and production, and on top of being the drummer in the band.
Everybody's given 110 all the time. So it's nice to hang out with friends and get a lot done and like make good art together. Prove yourself to me. You
don't have to. That piece was produced by reporter Paul C. Kelly Campos. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Some of your favorite comics from the 1970s may have been drawn by Filipino immigrants. Major American publishers like DC Comics recruited artists from the Philippines who wanted more exposure outside of their country. Despite their talent, publishers underpaid them. They drew stories ranging from horror to King Arthur. Today, the Cartoon Art Museum in San Francisco is paying homage to these artists, along with other Filipino artists over six decades. The exhibit is called Pinoy Power. Cartoonist Rina Ayuyang is a co-curator. She spoke with KALW's Janae Darden.
Rina, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
This is such an interesting exhibit. You know, when we talk about, you know, Filipino history and labor in this country, it's usually about farming. And I'm always, it's funny, as a journalist, I'm like, there's so much we don't know about this country. And I had no idea that major American publishers were hiring Filipino immigrant artists. Did you know about that before co-curating this exhibit?
Yeah, I knew about it. I guess it was just like looking at covers and looking at people's names, like seeing some of the superhero issues that I had from like the 70s, 80s that my brother had. And I remember seeing like Ernie Chan's name or Ernie Chua's name. He goes by two different last names sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I was just kind of drawn to like, who are these people who are inkers and they don't have names like Jack Kirby or, you know, like Alex Toth or, and so I was just wanted to research more about them. And I just learned, you know, just from researching them that there were a bunch of inkers and pencilers and just publishers and writers that were making comics in the Philippines before, you know, they had their own studios, they had their own publishing companies, kind of felt like they were doing self-publishing themselves and pretty successful during the 70s, 80s. DC and like Marvel, they weren't doing as well as they are doing now. They were also doing some cost-cutting moves and they also wanted to bring in cheaper and faster artists. And Tony DeZuniga, who is one of the first Filipino cartoonists who decided to come to the U.S. to see how comics making in the U.S. was like, he introduced Carmen Infantino, who was the DC publisher at the time. He introduced them to a whole bunch of other Filipino cartoonists that were doing work in the Philippines and brought them over. And so a lot of these men are in this exhibit at the Cartoon Art Museum.
How did you feel about learning this information, learning about these Filipino artists from the 70s as a Filipino artist yourself?
Well, I knew that, you know, from my Lola, my grandmother, she would come visit and she would bring these pop magazines and like teen beat type magazines from the Philippines. In these magazines, there'd be, you know, romance comics. They'd be like epic comics. So I knew that Filipino artists, cartoonists existed.
And I want to name some of these artists that are featured in the exhibit. Alex Nino, Alfredo Alcala, is that pronounced Alcala? Mm-hmm. Nestor Redondo. And they were well known back in the 70s. But like you said, there's others that may not have been as well known.
Yeah.
And I understand from your exhibit that often so many stories with immigrants, they were underpaid.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking DC, you know, these big publishers, do you know if they knew they were being underpaid?
I think they probably, you know, I there has been stories that there was a deal, recruited them over, that they got a cut of what they were being paid for. What everybody is like aspiring artists who are trying to make it into a new, like, you know, internationally or a different market, a different country. They're just happy to have exposure and have a taste of working for a big company like Marvel and DC. So when I was learning more about it, there is that pattern of going to other countries to find cheaper and faster. I know that Alfred Alcala is known to be one of like the fastest cartoonists, inkers. So that was one of the draws in recruiting him for DC, was that he could, I think he could do like 12 pages in 9 hours.
Oh my goodness.
So it was like, it felt like they were totally taking advantage of these men's like skills and expertise.
For the major comic books, what were some of the characters they were drawing? From what I read, it was a lot of horror. Mm-hmm. Were there other characters too?
Yes, what's interesting about them is that they were very popular in the Philippines. So Nestor Redondo, he co-created this iconic Filipino comics character called Darna, who is like a Wonder Woman in the Philippines. So they came on and recruited to do like, you know, Conan. Alex Nino did stuff for Heavy Metal. But they worked on a lot of anthologies, like horror anthologies or like paranormal war stories. Some of them worked for like Classic Illustrated type publications. Yeah, I was working, like, I think Nestor worked on Swamp Thing, just different characters like that. But like Alfred Alcala, he made this character called Voltar. And it was like a Conan character. It was a Viking hero. I think it has kind of inspired, it's like one of the visually, the first visual representations of Conan, like pre-Frank Frazetta, you know. And so he was able to bring that type of Voltar Viking hero comic into how he would show Conan in the 70s.
So this exhibit also features contemporary artists. You are a contemporary artist. How does those artists from the past, from the 70s, you think, impact contemporary Filipino artists today?
Well, I think a lot of Filipino artists like look at the artists in the 70s and 80s and admire the artistry, admire how they were able to work for Marvel and DC. And so seeing Filipinos being a part of that whole industry is really empowering and inspiring. And so I think to know that they are part of the history of comics, and that we are now part of that industry and being now we're in the current part of history in comics is kind of profound. You just feel like you belong. You are a cartoonist, like you belong in this industry.
That was cartoonist and curator Rina Ayuyang speaking with KLW's Janae Darden. That interview was co-produced by Porfirio Rangel. The Pinoy Power exhibit is running at the Cartoon Art Museum in San Francisco until April 28th. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Last week was the one-year anniversary of the death of legendary San Francisco drag icon, Heclina. She died at 55. Heclina was a pillar of the Bay Area drag scene, but her name actually comes from her Icelandic roots.
I just moved here from Reykjavik, Iceland, and it's one of those things where you think of your name in 5 seconds. It was... there's a volcano in Iceland called Hekla. And I was entering this pageant and I was gonna sing a song in Icelandic and I thought Hekla, Heklina, and you know, and whatever. It just kind of, I performed and it was a big disaster. I got really drunk and I don't remember it, any of it, but the name stuck.
She was certainly a force of nature. Like a volcano, she changed the landscape of drag in San Francisco. Heclina moved to the Bay Area in the 1990s, and in 2015, she purchased and became co-owner of the Soma nightclub known as Oasis. Heclina used this space to host drag events like Mother, which launched the careers of many other drag artists. And Heclina was also a lover of public radio. She even came to visit our studios in 2018 to help raise money for KALW during one of our membership drives.
We have to keep the flavor of San Francisco going. We can't let it be homogenized. And I think it's important that we have these voices that are happening and still able to happen and be there in our city.
To honor Heclina's impact on queer culture in the Bay, we bring you an interview I did with her in 2020. Here's an excerpt where she talks about what it was like when Oasis first opened and how San Francisco has since changed.
So let's talk about Oasis.
Yes.
Go back to 2014 and the vision.
Okay. You know, Darcy and Jeff, my two partners, they were looking for a space to open a club, and we looked at everything, and I was kind of along for the ride. I got the sense that they could not do it without me because I had a name, you know. I also had some money, and truth be told, I did want my own venue. I'd gotten a bit tired of performing at other people's venues, and when we did open Oasis, we had a vision for how a performance space should look. There should be a dressing room with mirrors and a bathroom and, you know, well lit, and it should be joined directly to the stage, so you walk from the dressing room directly onto stage. That was our vision. I wasn't as gung-ho about doing it, but I was along for the ride, and I believed in it, and I still do.
And for folks who have not been there, how would you describe Oasis?
It is the foremost performance venue in San Francisco. It is a place where all of the traveling cabaret acts, you know, if they perform in San Diego or LA, they're going to come and perform in the same leg of that tour at Oasis. And by them, I mean drag stars that are, you know, nationally recognized. And we do original programming, we do plays there, and we have nightclubs. And so it is a nightclub.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very fabulous nightclub, owned by two drag queens. You know, that is the face of it, and that really is what it is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you're talking about it with what? Like, what are you feeling right now as you remember and talk about Oasis?
Well, I mean, I'm going to miss it. I tell you what I'm not going to miss is the headache of running a business in San Francisco. I'm not going to miss that. What I am going to miss are the amazing people that I do work with. The performers that I bring in from other cities, the performers that live here in San Francisco. I was rehearsing for a performance a couple weeks ago with a bunch of people, and I was having so much fun with them. And I got a little bit misty-eyed, you know, and I was like, oh, I'm going to miss this. But I think absence will make the heart grow fonder.
What do you think, you know, San Francisco is changing in very big ways. The homelessness, the, you know, skyrocketing rents. What's happening to the drag community as a result, do you think?
This is a really long discussion, but I feel like San Francisco for me has been kind of death by a thousand cuts, sort of a little bit. Like every week there's something that's chopped away at it. You know, that the magic for me that was here when I first moved here is being cut into a lot. And sometimes I'll be at Oasis like on a daytime party on a Sunday and go, oh, all these young kids, how great these young kids can be here and survive and party. And then I check in and I look at all the young kids and they're all like Genentech and Facebook and Twitter. You know, that those are the only young kids who can survive here now. And when I moved to San Francisco, I worked in a crappy, I worked at Tower Video for minimum wage, and I survived on microwave popcorn from that I stole from the back of the video store. And I was able to go out nightclubbing and live that life, you know. And almost every drag queen I know who lives in San Francisco, who it's a hobby, they're all working tech jobs, or they're living with their parents, or, you know, or something like that.
Heclina died last year on April 3rd. She was 55. To Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. We'll meet an Afghan refugee who says most Americans misunderstand the true nature of Islam.
To be a practicing Muslim means to align your actions and your thoughts with beauty.
A story from the spiritual edge, tomorrow morning at 11. And before we go, here's some more music from the four-person gutter pop band, Plié. They'll be performing in San Francisco April 19th and 20th at the Kilowatt Bar in the Mission. Today's Cross Currents team includes Sarah Jesse, Lina Najia Basuni, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Shireen Adil, Lisa Morehouse, Angela Johnston, Sunni Khalid, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.